Welcome to Lynn Cullen Live, talk radio without the static. Email your questions and comments to lynncullenshow@gmail.com. And now your host, Lynn Cullen.
Hey, welcome to February. Yeah, welcome, February 1. I know I always sound nasal, but I just had a sneezing jag. I'm hoping it's ended because I think I'd counted up to 7. Man, the other day I was afraid. I felt like I was going to say, I don't know what it is about this hour. This 10 Eastern Standard Time is my sneezing time, apparently. God. Anyway, welcome to the program. Blue sky. I love it. I don't care if the temperature is frigid. Blue sky. Look at that. You know, those of us who come from other parts of the country, one of the things that takes a lot of getting used to when you come here to live, Pittsburgh, is the lack of blue sky. Those of you who've lived here forever maybe don't realize it. Which is good, because you don't know what you're missing. But those of us who come from, I don't know, other climes, wow, just so rarely that you see that blue. God bless it. Anyway, can I just start today with a few little nothing kind of about anything much, just things, and then we can get into the heavy stuff. Do you know how you like have maybe a show you watch on TV with some regularity that you enjoy because it's why you watch it with some regularity, and then there's something that the host of the show, some verbal tic that starts to annoy you. And I'm telling you right now, I want to know. I want to know what verbal tics I have. I'll recognize them that annoy you. Please, don't be shy. I'm serious, because I, as a viewer or a listener, often find myself reacting to a repetition by the host that is innocuous, that 99.9% of all the other people watching or listening do not react to. And it makes me feel like I'm an exceedingly judgmental and or irritable person, I guess. Especially when it comes to verbiage. And I know I have my own. It's why, I jump on my sister with, go ahead. I mean, just things that drive me crazy. Now, that's a little different. That's sort of a power struggle. Welcome to my family. But I once, just speaking of my sister, she used to call, what was the word she used? Overused to the point of distraction for me. Everything was, starts with an S. It's an adjective that starts with an S and means incredible. And I can't remember it, thank God. Stupendous is what's coming, but that's not it. And she would say every, and it was, and that was, it's the same word over. I finally went crazy and said, you've got to stop. And she did. I don't think I've heard that because I can't even think of what the word is. She'd know. But once you become, once I called her attention to it, I think then she did realize that she was using it a lot. And I know I've made changes. So come on, tell me. Little things. I'll tell you one of because I'll tell you two of mine. I know I made a big thing about not watching news, but I have to admit, when I want a little fix of what, you know, what the cable guys are talking about, I've come upon a show that I didn't used to watch, but that I enjoy because I think the host is so bright. And I like a lot of what she gets into. And that is Nicole Wallace, who's on MSNBC at, I guess, 4. And it's weird because I don't like her voice. Her voice is off-putting, I find. And this is I know the subjectivity of people who come to us on television and radio. You know, we cannot help what we how we react. So that I know my voice, my demeanor is something that would be truly off-putting for some, and I completely understand that. And I, you know, get put off. Why does it go one way when you're saying off-putting and then goes put off when you're saying the other thing? I don't know. So anyway, I really think she's bright. She's a reformed Republican, actually served in the George Bush White House, W. But she does, so she didn't have her career in television, where she's a host, has, you know, I don't know how many years, but someone's got to tell her she has got to stop going into a commercial break with the same thing over and over. And I've taken to, like, literally screaming back at the TV. So she'll finish up, you know, an interesting conversation with some guests. And then she'll say something to the effect of, you know, well, listen, we got a lot more and here's what's coming up. And then she says, don't go away. And it goes to the break. Now, a lot of people say don't go away when they're heading into a commercial. But they don't say it every single goddamn time. You cannot repeat the same thing over and over. And after a while, it sounds like she's telling me. You know, and then my sense of independence and freedom must kick in. And I think, don't you tell me where I go. You tell me don't go away. I'll go where I damn well play. I'm not kidding you. This is the kind of thing that goes on. And I mean not that. But I find myself literally screaming a few times, don't go away, she'll say. And I'll say, it drives me crazy. And is that benign a thing? You see? Am I nuts? Yes, I suppose. But I think everybody else must react in that way. Here's another one. PBS, Finding Your Roots host. Again, not a television person. And maybe that's the problem. They're new to hosting television. Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates. I love the show, even though it's becoming a little formulaic for my taste, but it's interesting to me. And he digs into, you know, people's ancestral histories and uncovers stuff. Like, you know, a slave-owning relative, a crook in the family, a hero in the family. I remember once with, what was it, John Lithgow. I mean, it turns out like every one of his ethnic came over on the Mayflower. I mean, it's unbelievable historical placement throughout his family. And that he did not even know of, which was bizarre. So anyway, Henry Louis Gates must ask the same question of his guest 4 or 5 times during the interview with them. And it's after he's given them some piece of information about their ancestors, he says, "How does that make you feel?" Now, obviously, his intent is to elicit some interesting reaction from his guest. I want to write to him. He's a bright, obviously, man. I want to say, "Hey, how does that make you feel?" is about as weak a question as an interviewer could ever ask. It's also that intrusive and insipid kind of a thing, too. How does that make you feel? And he says it all the time, and I just want to scream. So, stuff like that. So I thought, I wonder what it is I say that drives people nuts. And Ray, thank you. Ray has responded. He says, I say, that drives him nuts, just saying. Really? See, I don't know that. I say, just saying? Oh, man. Okay. Well, Ray, that's in my head now. Just saying. Yeah, it's in my head. And what happens is if it gets in my head, I will then note when it comes out of my mouth and, you know, maybe change. Just say it. Do I really? And did I really yesterday with Susan say gab smocked? I should have gone back and listened. Gab smocked? Did I? I kept saying, did I? And she said, yeah. Okay. And the other one that drives Ray crazy, I can tell by the way he's put it here phonetically that it's me using my, you know, I'm verbally, I always say I use my instrument. He says, I say, unbelievable. Is that right? Unbelievable. Was there an accent on one of them? See, I don't know. I can see myself saying that. But I say that a lot. Unbelievable. And just saying. Okay. Thank you for that. Barbara writes, I heard Nicole Wallace yesterday. Oh, she also says she has no problem with my voice. Well, you're odd, Barbara, or Nicole Wallace's voice. She says Ron DeSantis is such an annoying voice. You know what? I don't know what he sounds like. I think, and that shows you I don't watch television news. I don't know what he sounds like. I don't want to know. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, her voice. I can't conjure her voice either. And then Barbara says, maybe I just don't like Southern accents. Huh. I don't know. Barbara says that Marjorie Taylor Greene was saying that she wanted the House to review the shooting of Ashley Babbitt. That's where we're going to go. That'll be her January 6th committee kind of investigation. Who shot the woman who was part of the insurrection? Jesus. Oh, man. All righty. All right. Well, you guys are either too kind or you're not. Not willing. Anyway, let me know. And but it's, I come from an exceedingly, I think, judgmental family environment. And it's not good. I mean, it does make me, I think, over, you know, react to things that everybody else around me is in this sort of, you know, placid state. And I'm like, okay, never mind. That's it. Oh, one other thing, though. I did come upon this on Twitter today. It was a guy complaining about a pronunciation of a word. And again, you know, words, stuff like this, I just love it. He wrote, I actually took a screenshot of his thing. Let me get it. He said this, and I've wondered the same thing. He says, I've always pronounced integral with the emphasis on the first syllable, integral. But I keep hearing people on podcasts emphasizing the second syllable, and it's driving me crazy. In other words, they're saying integral. And yes, we both heard both. It's driving me crazy. Well, I immediately went to the comments to see what people thought. And oh my God, the number of like-minded folk who were driven crazy by people saying integral. But then someone said, and they're right, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know. I didn't look it up. I could have looked it up. I think this is likely because syllable stress can change a word's part of speech, such as content, which is an adjective. I was content. Or content, same word, two-syllable word, different meaning. And even form of speech, yeah, that's a noun, content, as opposed to content. Boy, learning English must be such a bitch. So a lot of people did say that integral is used as an adjectival form, and integral is used as a noun. And I bet that's right. But I think I'll just keep saying integral. But I think that's probably right. And the proper usage is integral for a noun and integral for the, I don't know. And then people got into one is math related, the integral, and the other is, I don't know. And then somebody said that Marlon Brando actually had a story in his autobiography about, I guess, getting into a set two with someone about exactly this, the pronunciation of integral and an integral. Okay, that's it. Sorry. Oh, God. I have a caller. Oh, my God. Okay. Hello.
Good morning, Lynn.
Hi.
This is Ella. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, Ella.
Well, here we go. I just got done reading a book, Vinny and Abraham, by Dawn Fitzgerald, and I learned do you know Vinny Ream? Does that ring
no.
a bell? Well, she was
no.
the first female to be commissioned by Congress. And what her statement was, we know we can only portray what's within us. And she has a statue in Madison, Wisconsin that she sculptured, and she has one also in Madison, Wisconsin. And she was
I should know her. I was
right.
Spent a lot of time in Madison. The name's not ringing a bell.
I mean, she was the first female to be commissioned by Congress to
something.
If she started at the Civil War, beginning of the Civil War, and Abraham Lincoln would be walking down the street, and finally she wanted to do his sculpture, and she was so young, and I guess I didn't think she was talented, but
she was a woman,
right? But she got the job.
Wow!
And she was raised in it's R E A M, is how you spell her last name. And you really want to know what I don't like? I don't like when you use God's name in vain.
Okay, you're not alone.
Okay. Well, that's good.
And I've been told that before, but you can see it didn't help. I mean,
right.
Maybe I don't do it as much as go ahead.
It's not within you. to be doing it.
Oh, that's what you're
always,
saying.
You always talk how beautiful the world is and the sun and the moon and the stars. And we know who created all that. But we'll work on it. That's okay.
Okay. Oh, what a sweetie you are.
Oh,
okay, Ella. Ella, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Thank you.
So
okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Oh, jeez. What a nice woman. See, even one of the nicest, I was going to say the nicest woman who listens to the program came in with a criticism. It's good. I don't know what the rest of you are sitting on. Okay. So I'll get off. I was going to respond a little bit more to what Ella's criticism was, but I think I'll let it go because I know she's not alone. I got that reaction when I was on the radio. And, you know, on the radio, you can't swear. So, but I still got the reaction from just saying things like, I don't know. What would I have been able to say? I don't know. But I still managed to offend people who, you know, say you should not take the Lord's name in vain. I guess we can argue about what his name is, or her name, or its name. Right. So maybe that gets us into trouble. But when people make that criticism, I fully understand what they're saying. And I apologize for the offense I give. Obviously not enough to make Ella go away, but still. So I think that's it for all my little nitpicky kinds of things that I wanted to share with you. Oh, one other. See, I know it. I'm constantly interrupting myself. I saw a picture of George Santos today that made me feel bad for him. Now, that takes some doing. It was a picture, like all pictures are of him. There's always a bunch of people behind him with cameras and microphones. And I mean, the guy obviously cannot venture anywhere without being trailed by a scrum of photographers and reporters and curious bystanders and who knows what, all of which he brought on himself, of course. But this guy, I guess the picture was different in that he looked different. You know how he's looked the whole time since he showed up at Congress. We first sort of saw him during the marathon attempt to get Kevin McCarthy, you know, the speaker's gavel. And Santos was always dressed pretty much the same, right? He had a sport jacket or a suit, and he had a crew neck sweater plus a tie. I mean, he had all the bases covered, and he had these black glasses. And that's pretty much, you know, the way he's looked, sometimes without the tie, but always with the sweater. Anyway, all remember the fashion section of the New York Times talked about how he clearly uses his clothing as a communication device, and for a chameleon like him, somebody who changes his story, his reality, his name, his gender, his whatever. With a fluidity which boggles the mind. Also, I guess, for each iteration, there needs to be a wardrobe change as well. So when I saw this picture of him, which I guess was taken yesterday, and at first I didn't recognize him because gone were the glasses, gone the sweater, gone the tie, the shirt on top button unbuttoned, and the, okay, so, and he's still, he's obviously in the Congress, and maybe this is after he said, all right, I won't sit on the committees I've been assigned to until things are cleared up, or I'm perp walked out of here, or whatever. So, I'm thinking, there's something, there was a look on his face, and I get, part of my empathic heart went out to this being, this fellow human, who must be so mentally ill. I mean, he just must suffer from to be the pathological liar that he is. Audacious liar that he is. The audacity of thinking you can run for office, and that, you know, big position in this media besotted culture, and say you're this, that, and the other thing, the audacity of daring to do it, then he succeeds in doing it. I mean, he's nuts. Can you imagine? I mean, I wonder what the glasses ought to, you wonder what goes through his mind. I mean, you wonder for a second or two, and then you move on to things that might be a little more important. But I don't know why. I can't imagine being him. I mean, playing out this role on such a national stage, international stage even, and to, I mean, the humiliation. I mean, he's been found out. It's just mind-boggling. Anyway, made me wonder, and how anyone would want to stay in that situation. Maybe he's staying because he knows inevitably he's going to end up in court because he's been skirting on the edges of the law for, I suspect, much of his life and whatever. I was going to say the cows are coming home to roost. Is there a phrase about the cows doing something? I know they don't roost. But what's the phrase about roosting? It's not the it's chickens. Chickens coming home to roost. Never mind. Oh, my poor head. I have a caller. Yay. Hello.
You don't say anything that annoys me.
Well, you're too easy. You're like an easy grader.
You sound like my wife now. She says the same thing. But
yeah, we are. You know. Yeah.
Well, yeah, well, Santos. I think that he's. You're right. I think he's damaged. But you know, if you lied to get any job, you just gracefully bow out. And
yeah.
And the thing is, it's setting such a terrible example. You know, you just lie until you get the job. And the fact that nobody, I mean, people want him gone. Even Republicans want him gone. Some of them, yeah. Not everybody. But the fact that McCarthy would even give him, put him on committees, says a lot about McCarthy, too.
And well, the fact that the Republicans knew about him. They needed his vote, so they look the other way. And, you know, for the Republicans, I hope he stays around as long as possible and continues to make them look like the – I it's one thing to be him. It's the other thing to be the Republicans willing to take him in and using him and knowing full well what he is. That says more about them. I mean, I think they're more vile than this poor messed up soul.
Sure, but I mean, I guess the thing that's always bothered me, especially with the behavior of all these pundits and then what all these, these right wingers have been saying the past year, it really came home for me when on election day 2016 is the behavior that all our young people are witnessing. Yeah. Being accepted and okay, so what are we going to be talking about February 8th after the State of the Union address? How awful Green and Bobart are, because are they going to go up there and mock the president, or tell me if anybody remembers, did that ever happen before it happened to Obama?
Well, it may have, but it was before television. I have no idea. It was a Republican, yet the "you lie" thing during Obama's. Well, that probably that was a result of him. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Listen,
it's all inappropriate.
It's all inappropriate. Nobody even knows the term anymore. It's so obvious. We've lost any, there used to be, you're right. There used to be, this is what you do, this is what you don't do, this is appropriate, this is inappropriate. Quite clearly, there are so many people around now who have not a clue what's appropriate and inappropriate, who've raised another generation who are totally clueless about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. We're a few generations into this, I think. Social media, right? Social media has coarsened the conversation. The very fact, and listen to me talking about coarsening the conversation, the fact that I, on my show, swear, and that would be inappropriate relatively recently. So I'm part of this sort of that as well.
But are you being hurtful? Or are you just, we're having conversations, and unless there's real intent to hurt somebody, that's what upsets me. All these people, what kind of parenting did they get? What kind of parenting are they giving? And a lot of them claim to be good Christians. And the hell happened to, what would Fred Rogers be saying about all this shit? He would be
disappointed. I'm glad he's not here. Oh my God, I'm glad he's not here. I keep saying that about so many of the older people I've known who are wondrous and honorable, and like my father and Fred. And I'm glad they're spared. They are spared this. I'm truly glad. So anyway, well, all right, Roger, I'll work harder to annoy you then.
We all have to be good examples for people to view how we treat each other. I think you do a good job. So you swear. What the hell? I don't care. All right. We'll have a nice night.
Some people do. Hey, you too. Goodbye.
All right.
Goodbye. Bye. I want to get a few things in. There was a question I had wanted to ask Susan that slipped my mind yesterday that had occurred to me, and I wanted her take on the fact that in the latest horrific snuff film, the murder of Tyre Nichols, who was being buried today, how all the reason we see the cops were wearing, the people who brutalized him were wearing cameras, which were on, and they knew it. So my question was, what the, how, why? I mean, I'm incredulous. If you know what you're doing is obviously unnecessary, not nice, in fact, criminal, and you're recording it yourself. And then you're going to file a false report that contradicts what is there on your own body, the visual evidence. Where's the disconnect? That's what I was going to ask Susan. And I read something today which answered it. They were part of this special elite unit of the Memphis police. And the article was about these similar elite units all over the country and how, if you want to see the most brutal, the most this and that, you go to these elite units. Cops often feel above the law. You can tell. They're carrying their guns. They got their badges. But if you're an elite cop, there's an arrogance. You have been told you're an elite cop. You're part of this elite unit. It does something to your head, and you feel untouchable. That's what I think is the answer to how they could literally, I mean, take a man's life, and if they had bothered to think about it, they were destroying their lives as well. How many lives were destroyed? Now, they get to keep breathing. They get to keep living. Maybe they'll be breathing in a jail cell, but they get to keep living. But I think they thought they were above. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered. They were that all powerful. Just extraordinary. Thank you, Morgan. Morgan is our new producer person, Morgan and Kevin. And Morgan says, the phrase I'm probably looking for is until the cows come home. I knew they had to come, but they're not coming to roost. Right. Until the cows come home, which is a totally different phrase in terms of usage than the chickens coming home to roost. Right. Yeah. Thank you. Morgan, someday you will have an old brain that just can't quite find the right folder in the right file cabinet at the right time. Anyway, this is something I want to say before our time runs out. And it's about, I believe his name was already mentioned once. DeSantis, was it? Or was that Santos? DeSantis, the guy who wants to be your next president, and the guy who also wants to be the first American dictator, I think. And he's showing how it's done. In the what used to be the state of Florida, but which is now, I don't know what we call it now. It's DeSantis's fiefdom, where he decrees this and decrees that and decries this and decries that. And you talk about a person who feels they're above the law, who feels above it all. and with a lust for power and control, man, there's your guy. So it's becoming clear that one of the ways he's creating a brand, right, an image of himself, and to appeal to enough Americans to win a presidency. And one of the things that he's full on culture war. That's it. And that is the only way they can win, culture war, because they've got no policy proposals. None. Zero. It's all about culture. And that's a thing that makes me crazy, because I do think our side keeps providing unnecessary fodder and freebies to the Ron DeSantis's. But one of the things he's clearly doing is going after education. He's done it. I mean, he's starting to do it. So it's not unusual on this show for me to end up talking about the latest horror in the Florida public education system. I believe Susan and I were talking about it yesterday. Books. He's created a law, his cohorts in the legislature, and he have created a law that makes it illegal to have books that, I don't know, do all these amorphous kinds of make somebody feel bad, critical race theory, all of these sort of unformed, vague, subjective. And the thing is, teachers are so fearful of running afoul of these laws that they begin pulling back. So it's how self-censorship works. You don't need someone to censor you. They create a threat, and then you do the work. So teachers start pulling books, start pulling lesson plans that they fear might run afoul of this vague law. And I saw a comment by somebody saying the whole idea of how you do this kind of thing is by making the law so vague that what it leaves behind it is nothing but fear. Fear of overstepping, not quite knowing, but not sure. And so results in the self-censorship, the pulling back of. It's how you create an autocracy. You do that with something as seemingly simple as books in a classroom. But then you do it with other aspects of the culture, the civic culture, the political culture, whatever. And before long, you got a population running on fear, looking over their shoulders, afraid to say something, do something, lest it bring the wrath, the cops, something you don't want. So you can tell that he's definitely thinking education is one of the things I'm going to do. He has said that the way public education works now is there's lefties indoctrinating the children. Listen, public education has always been about indoctrination. I was indoctrinated in public school. You were indoctrinated in public school. Certain histories were taught. And if you have made it to a college afterwards, you were untaught almost everything you've been indoctrinated with. That's the way it's always been. Yes, public schools are there to make good citizens, and good citizens are ones that are more malleable, I suspect. So that, and that's what Ron DeSantis would think. He would like the schools to go back to being like the schools were that I went to in 1950 America. But as I said, I had to unlearn a whole hell of a lot I was taught, because it wasn't true. So he's now training his sights also on higher education in Florida. The Florida higher education system, the taxpayers there support, where did I see the number? It's a lot. 28 publicly funded universities, colleges, and community colleges. And he's going to start doing to them what he's done to elementary, middle, and high schools. He's targeted this one school, one of the smaller ones, and he packed their, I don't know, I've never heard of a governor with this kind of power. So he packs their board of directors, he ousts the president, and she has openly said this is a hostile takeover of her school, the new college is called, small school, but a publicly funded school. And she, and it was considered one of the more progressive schools. That's why he went after it. And she said, our students are taught. They read Marx and they argue with Marx. They take world religions. They do not become Buddhists in February and then turn into Christians in March. Yeah, well, I know she's right. But so here's a guy whose whole thing is that somehow we're being deprived, Americans are being deprived of their freedom. And look at what he does. Look at what he does. I'd sure like to know his definition of freedom. But I say this because one of the things that freaked me out today that I saw was so upsetting. As you know, one of the things he did targeting education was he went after the advanced placement course on African American studies, which was a pilot. It wasn't fully formed as a pilot program, still getting worked on. The College Board puts these AP programs out. And DeSantis said, we will not allow this program in Florida. And do you know what the College Board did yesterday? Not yesterday, today. Today's Wednesday, right? Yes. The College Board this morning released an altered curriculum for its advanced placement course in African American studies. And it has been stripped of much of the subject matter that DeSantis had targeted. They capitulated totally. He says you can't teach this in Florida, and I guess they were getting from other red states, the same kind of thing, and they capitulated. I am so stunned. The study of any contemporary topics like Black Lives Matter, affirmative action, the debate over reparations. Goodbye. The subjects are peripheral. They are no longer part of the exam, and they are simply offered on a list of options for a research project if you want to head down that path. And even that, the College Board now says, can be refined by local states and districts, saying, all right, here, we're giving you this, but if you're like DeSantis, you can pull whole parts of it out. Bell Hooks, she's gone. Ta-Nehisi Coates, He's gone. I have to tell you, this is frightening to me. And it shows, you know, it's that question I used to ask, how could like this, you know, literate, cultured country, that wouldn't be us, that'd be Germany, how could it turn into this monstrous evil that it became? And I think it's little things like this. This is, we're seeing it play out. Just on a drip, drip, drip basis. And the failure of people in positions of some power and authority to stand up against these attempts is so dispiriting to me. So, the College Board story, as I said, just dropped right before the show began, and I'm just sick. I'm just sick about it. Sick about it. Frightening. Ed writes, the AP program was explained on CBS Morning this morning. Did you hear it? No. Ed says, I'm not sure the College Board capitulated. Here is a link. Okay. So if I am, look, I mean, I read the fact that they pulled all the stuff. I mean, they pulled it and put it off to the side. The fact that they, why should the College Board care about the blatherings of any politician? That course was put together by some of the best academics in the field. I don't know. I will watch this thing you sent me, but obviously not going to do it right now. I have a little time left, and I'm going to share with you a book that I don't know if it'd make it into the AP program, but I keep reading reviews of it, and it really is getting rave reviews about a story that we never learned, but now is out. And it is about probably the most daring slave escapes ever. Ingenious and daring. And it took place in 1848. The name of the book is Master, Slave, Husband, Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom. And it is about a couple of slaves, Ellen and William Craft. Ellen was a light-skinned black. Obviously, the offspring of a rape. And in fact, she knew her mother had been raped by their owner. She was fair skinned. She was a seamstress, so she wasn't a field slave. She spent time around, you know, the house folk. She disguised herself as a wealthy young white man, a sick wealthy young white man, who was traveling with her slave. caregiver. That was her husband. And in that guise, with her wearing a top hat and her face partially bandaged, she and he boarded a train. And they pulled it off. I'm not going to go into how exactly, but they pulled it off. Now, they made it from Macon, Georgia to Philadelphia, a 4-day journey. But then they were free and they were living in Boston. And then the Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which meant that you could have crossed the Mason-Dixon line like they did. You could be living free, but you were still subject to capture. And they had developed such a group of protectors and friends. They had become very active in the abolitionist movement that people in Boston helped them to get out of the country. So in 1850, they escaped, sailed to England. And while in England, they published a memoir that was published in 1860. They started a family. They continued to advocate for abolition and eventually did return to the United States after so-called emancipation. There was, I mean, this is an amazing story. And the one of the reviews I read had a statement in it that has so boggled my mind that it makes me want to read the book. It is this. Ellen, that's the woman, the seamstress, Ellen, whose father and original owner was a white planter who had raped Ellen's mother, is credited with devising the escape. What? I'm just saying. Sounds like a fascinating story. Yes, and Kurt wants me to get in here. I saw that the creator of Peeps has died. I never was into Peeps, so I didn't, you know, we're not talking about the chronicler of Johnson, Samuel Peeps, P-E-P-Y-S. We're talking about Peeps, P-E-E-P-S, those non-nutritious, his name was Bob Bourne. Father of Peeps. He made marshmallow little chicks. You know, I want to say, I think he was an immigrant from Russia. I got to tell you, I think this guy had to be a Jewish immigrant. They don't say that here, do they? Yeah, has to be. Because his first name was actually Ira, but call him Bob. And his father, Sam, who was a Russian immigrant, those are Jews. And they moved to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where the Just Born Quality Confections is still based. Making Peeps. Anyway, so there he is, Bob Bourne. Okay. Hey, thank you all. This is, I enjoyed it, even though you didn't give me a lot of feedback on what annoys you about me, but that's okay. And I don't think I said just saying, did I? Or be unbelievable? Is that the other one? Whatever. Okay. Hey, I'm going to chase this blue sky a little bit, if you don't mind. And I'll be back tomorrow. Okay? Toodaloo.
Lynn Cullen Live, Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and archived at pghcitypaper.com. The opinions expressed on Lynn Cullen Live are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of Pittsburgh City Paper or its advertisers.